didn't hurt at all anymore. During the day, he preached, and she, his first disciple, held the basket. She wore a sheet wrapped around her all the way up and over her head at first, like a hood, until he spied a wig in a trash can out in an alleyway behind a building. From then on, she wore the wig. It was a black, curly wig with a plasticky halo of frizz at the crown, and half of it was longer than the other, like something you would get at a Halloween store in a plastic bag. The underneath part of it was stiff and scratchy from being crumpled in one position for too long. It poked into her head. It smelled like garbage. John David said it was to cover her hair, which had grown almost down to her waist, and darkened from white blonde to gold. Her hair, he said, was a powerful blessing. God had wreathed her in light. She covered it when they were outdoors so that others wouldn't make her unclean by looking at it. With the wig, she no longer had to wrap the sheet over her head. She got her peripheral vision back, and this meant she had to relearn to ignore the way people looked at them. She kept her face down most of the time anyway. She barely heard the words that John David yelled at passers-by, although she could see their feet as they hurried past them. In his hands, a cardboard sign. At her feet, a basket. If she stared down at the feet hard enough, if she willed them to, sometimes a pair would stop in front of her and throw money into the basket. When this happened, John David never faltered in his harangue, but she could feel how pleased he was with her. On the best days, they sang. He would take the money out of the house, away from her, and come home late, smelling sweet and sour, and collapse into his bed without visiting her in the little room. This was the thing she liked most in the world, when he was pleased with her and fell asleep without touching her. She wanted to be alone with herself sometimes. She wanted to meditate on her sins. They were legion. Once they went to the soup kitchen, but the soup kitchen was filled with men who looked, to her, like wild beasts in their dank overcoats and stained sweatshirts. Most of the men left her alone, but a few didn't. A man she sat next to at the long cafeteria table grinned and put his hand between her thighs. She froze. John David was gone for only a moment, and when he came back and saw the leering, stubbly face, he knew what was happening. The man knew, too, and he jerked his hand away like it had been burned and picked up his tray and skittered off. Esther was filled with shame. Later, she was punished. The food pantry, by contrast, was frequented by women with shopping carts and squalling babies who lined up outside until it opened. The food pantry was just a shed in the parking lot of a church, and it wasn't heated, and the people who ran the food pantry were as cold as the cans of peas and corn they passed over the counter. Some days it was all soggy green beans, and when they opened the cans at home and ate the beans, John David made her drink the olive-green salty water with its floating bits of bean skin afterward, because her wrists looked alarming poking out of her robes. Other times they got refried beans, her favorite, and small cans of peaches and pears in syrup. She saved the curled-up aluminum lids, tabs still attached, under her bunk, where they were, not hidden exactly, but hers. She had no secrets from John David, and he could see everything anyway. He knew the lids were there, but benevolently let her have a dark place to hide. While the bed creaked beneath them, she meditated on the accumulation of silver curves, imagined herself ice skating along their dramatic slopes, hopping from one to the other, or even sailing in them like little boats. And then the boats turned to flower petals bobbing in a pond. And then for one horrible moment they were metal again, scratching and screeching against one another. And then all was silent and he was gone. One morning, John David didn't come downstairs for her. Esther waited anxiously in bed. She was not allowed to leave the bed until he bade her to every morning. She was afraid that if she got out of bed now, he would come back and beat her. Or worse, that he would never come back at all. It might be a test. Perhaps there was some reason he wouldn't let her out of bed. Perhaps the floor would kill her. She thought about the lids under the bed. They would not let the floor kill her. She listened. She waited. Later, when she had woken and slept innumerable times, Her stomach began growling too loudly for her to ignore. It was like a vacuum inside her. She got up and put her feet down without thinking, realized that the floor had not electrocuted her, thanked the lids, and went upstairs. There was only one can of creamed corn on the counter. She opened it and ate it. The sweet starchiness went straight into her bloodstream. For an instant, her brain felt oxygenated and fizzy. "Where are you?" she dared to ask out loud, partly because she knew he wasn't there and wouldn't answer. She reached for the feeling of his omnipotence, but it shrank back and she felt that he was not only gone, but also no longer looking at her. The thought made her cold and she shivered. On the third day, Esther went to the food pantry alone. It was the bravest thing she'd ever done, but she knew the way. She kept her head down as much as possible and wore a scarf tied around her wig. A babushka, she thought. The word surfacing from another plane of existence, as words sometimes did these days. She stood in line. The women standing in line stared at her. One elderly woman with a babushka like hers leaned forward over a grocery cart she had pushed across the bumpy parking lot. A very tall woman with a short, tight skirt and a long blonde wig snuck glances. A junkie, a twitchy woman of indeterminate age with long, greasy brown hair, stared openly for a moment, then looked abruptly away. A woman with a weave turned away from the counter and walked down the line, humming and swinging a plastic grocery bag clanking with cans. A box of animal crackers rattled on the top of the pile. Esther could feel her approach, could feel everyone else feeling her approach. She needed food.
"Sugar, where your friend at today?" the woman asked.
Esther kept her head down.
"I said, where your friend at?"
the woman repeated.
"He is your friend, isn't he?"
The others pretended to mind their own business, but the twitchy woman in front of her, angry red marks glaring through the open cuffs of her oversized shirt, was the only one who seemed truly unconcerned with the conversation. Esther could feel the tension mounting. Another woman came shuffling away from the counter, cradling her cans in a windbreaker with its sleeves tied together. There was only one woman ahead of her in line now. She held her breath.
"Sugar, I'm talking to you. Who's that man used to come here with you?"
She had to say something.
"He's my dad," she whispered, keeping her head down.
"Mm-hmm. Where'd he run off to?"
the woman asked immediately, as if this question were on the tip of her tongue. Another word floated up through Esther's brain and came out of her mouth in a whisper.
"Laundromat."
She pointed to her right as if indicating something around the corner, just a few blocks away at most.
"Huh."
The woman looked her up and down, taking in her dirty white sheet and sneakers, which were separating from their soles at the toes, and lingering on the wig.
"Your mama know where you at?"
the woman demanded. Esther didn't hesitate. "She's dead," she said, eyes on the ground.
"Uh-huh."
The woman appraised her skeptically.
"Leave her alone, Janice,"
said the tall blonde with the teetering heels in a low, guttural voice.
"It's some custody shit."
The woman named Janice snapped back.
"Mothers gotta be with their daughters, especially when the father is unfit."
She drew out the last word with a big pause between the syllables and looked pointedly at the blonde woman's heels and ropey, exposed legs.
"Fuck you, Jay,"
said the blonde, then sighed.
"Besides, for all you know, her mama could be worse. I know mine was."
The argument continued, but by this time the junkie was shuffling away from the front of the line, her baggy jeans and the pocket of her flannel shirt weighed down with cans, and Esther stepped up hurriedly. All the cans of Frank's were gone, but there was a can of chickpeas and another of refried beans, so she pointed to them wordlessly. The pantry worker was an older woman who was there often. With an expressionless face, she pushed an extra can of peaches across the counter.
"Here," she said. "I've been saving these for you. If you ever need anything, let me know."
Esther couldn't bring herself to nod in case he was watching from somewhere close by, testing her. But she made eye contact with the woman for just a moment and tried to thank her for the peaches with a half smile. The woman named Janice was gone when she turned back, and the tall blonde woman had folded her arms and was muttering to herself. The junkie was weaving back and forth down the sidewalk. Suddenly she put her hands up toward heaven and crowed toward the sky. Esther hurried home, tennis shoes tripping over the tangled sheet. She wondered if John David would know she'd gone out of the house, and if so, what her punishment would be. If this had been a test, she had failed. Esther thought about Abraham and the Bible tying up his son Isaac, the raised knife flashing in the early morning sun, like John David told her. God, too, had sacrificed his son Jesus. Always sons, never daughters. Were daughters too important, or was it the opposite? She walked into the kitchen, ate, went down the stairs at the back of the pantry, and lay down in her bed to await further instructions. From her bed, she heard the back door creak open, and two pairs of feet started moving through the kitchen upstairs. She almost didn't recognize John David's voice at first. It was pitched higher and reminded her of someone she had known a long time ago, a man with a guitar. He was talking with a second voice, and though she couldn't hear the words, the tone was friendly. The second voice belonged to a girl with heavy footsteps. A chair screeched across the floor, accompanied by a squeal of pain and a burst of laughter. Whoever she was clumsy.
"Esther!"
he yelled into the pantry.
"Esther, come up here!"
She glanced at the wig, the sheet draped over the foot of the bed. As if he could see her, he yelled,
"We're not going outside. Don't worry about your shoes and stuff. Just come up and meet someone."
Meet someone. She walked warily up the stairs in her nightshirt. A young girl, maybe a little younger than Esther, stood in the kitchen next to John David. She was short, with dyed black hair pulled into scraggly pigtails. She wore a black T-shirt and a short black skirt that poofed out above her knees, exposing smudged white legs over faded rainbow socks.
"Esther, this is Charlotte," John David said.
She saw with a shock that he had shaved his beard. A memory fizzed through her brain of a guitar with an embroidered strap, a room with posters on the walls. His skin that had been hidden under the beard looked pinkish and bumpy like chicken skin. His mouth looked small and thin-lipped. There was a tiny cut above his Adam's apple. Charlotte rhymes with harlot. Esther kept her eyes on the floor, but she was aware that Charlotte was staring at her and became suddenly self-conscious about her appearance. Ratty nightshirt over jeans he'd stolen from a dumpster. Dirty, naked feet sticking out from the frayed cuffs. She wondered if the nightshirt smelled bad. It had never been washed.
"Charlotte, Esther's my niece. She's been crashing here for a little while."
There was that voice again, the new old John David who reminded her of when she was someone else, a long time ago. He turned and addressed himself to Esther in that kind, friendly voice, and it made her want to cover her ears and sing until she couldn't hear it anymore. But she knew better.
"Esther, can Charlotte use your computer to check her email? She's a long way from home, and I know she would really appreciate it."
Esther didn't have a computer. She knew what was required of her, though. She nodded without looking up.
"Great. I'll just take her down and get her set up in your room. Do you mind hanging out up here for a few minutes?"
Esther nodded acquiescence and stepped away from the door. As they passed her, Charlotte said,
"Thanks."
Esther looked up at her quickly, caught a glimpse of brown eyes with a shimmer of green or gold in their depths. She put a hand out to grab Charlotte's arm, but Charlotte had seen the narrow door in the back of the pantry by then.
"Whoa! Is this like a secret passage or something?"
she said.
"Bomb shelter,"
John David said, hovering behind her shoulder.
"No way! This house belonged to my grandparents," he said. "My grandfather was a fighter pilot in the Pacific. He was scouted for NASA in 61. They could have moved out to a big house in Clear Lake, but my grandmother believed the Cold War would end in a nuclear holocaust. She believed Jesus would scourge the earth."
His voice sounded far away. She convinced him to build an underground bunker here.
"That is trippy,"
Charlotte said appreciatively. It was trippy. Esther had never heard any of it. Thinking about John David's grandparents made him seem suddenly very ordinary.
You can't have a basement at sea level, but with about 10 tons of concrete, you can have a fallout shelter.
The words tumbled through her head, a history lesson casually delivered as if the man speaking weren't outside of history, weren't divine, as if he were just a man living in a house.
Your niece is so lucky. This is the coolest bedroom ever.
Charlotte's voice receded down the staircase with her footsteps. As the two of them vanished into blackness, Esther understood for the first time what was going to happen. She understood for the first time that it had happened to her. She curled up on the sofa and put her hands over her ears, but she still heard it. No words, just Charlotte's voice getting higher and shriller, and then a thump and another thump. Something dropped on the concrete basement floor with a clatter. Muffled yells, the sound of shoes sliding against the floor as if scrambling for purchase. A short silence, something heavy being dragged. And then a sort of stuttering bark she recognized after a moment as the sound of duct tape being ripped off a roll. John David appeared at the top of the stairs looking weary and dropped a bundle of clothes on the pantry floor. He filled a plastic bucket with water at the kitchen sink and handed it to Esther.
"Bathe her," he said.
The concubines bathed and perfumed her and braided her hair. The sponge was a new blue kitchen sponge, soft on one side and scratchy on the other. The bucket was unexpectedly heavy and swung a little as she took it, splashing a bit of water over the edge onto his shoes. He walked to the sofa to lie down. The exercise had exhausted him, drained him of the emotional electricity that usually seemed to vibrate off him in waves. Lying with his eyes closed, he looked smaller. She took a step toward him, but he drew his elbow up over his eyes and turned toward the sofa back. In a moment, he was snoring. She wondered what he was doing up here all those times while she trembled in her room downstairs. Napping on the sofa? Fixing himself a sandwich? These thoughts filled her with dread. She turned away and walked to the pantry door. She stepped over the pile of clothes, pulled this way and that like a cast-aside doll. The black T-shirt lay on top, inside out and twisted double, so that the picture on the front was only a blocky outline, puckering the fabric. The letters on the back, backward and illegible. She started down the stairs. Before she could see Charlotte, she smelled her. She'd peed herself. Then her eyes adjusted, and gradually a glimmer of whiteness grew and spread into the shape of a torso. Charlotte lay naked on the floor. Her hands were duct-taped behind her back, her shins duct-taped solidly together in a silver column, so that in the dim light it looked as if her legs had been cut off below the knees, her white feet lying nearby like a pair of sneakers. A piece of duct tape was pressed over the bottom half of her small round face, a little bump showing where the lip ring was. Her eyes were closed. The concubines bathed and perfumed her and braided her hair. Esther knelt down, her knees making cold contact with the concrete. She put the bucket and the sponge on the floor beside her and waited. This was too much. She would go back upstairs, tell John David she couldn't do it. Esther inched toward the body on her knees, trying not to look, feeling hot tears coming to her eyes. She put out a hand, moving closer and closer to where angry pink circles blotched the soft white belly in clusters of four, like fingertips over her ribs, then pulling back. She took up the sponge and dipped it in the water, which had started out lukewarm but was nearly cool by now. Careful to keep the rough side of the sponge facing away from Charlotte, she very gently applied one wet, soft corner to the bruises that stained the white expanse of stomach, as if the water could wash them away. The girl's eyes flew open. Esther started backward with a shriek. Charlotte, unable to scream, moaned into the tape and raised her head only to shake it wildly back and forth, strands of her too black hair coming out of her pigtails and floating in front of eyes that were all white. She rolled onto one shoulder and jackknifed her bound legs back and forth until she managed to kick Esther hard on the side of her knee.
Esther gasped and put a hand to her leg, but the impact of the kick overbalanced Charlotte, and she fell back and hit her head on the concrete. Then she lay still. Esther picked up the sponge, which had landed close to her feet in the scuffle.
"I'm just going to give you a bath," she reassured Charlotte. "It won't hurt."
The concubines bathed and perfumed her and braided her hair.
"I have to bathe you," she said. "You have to be made clean."
The girl began moving her legs again, but slowly this time, as if tired out by her initial fury, bracing her feet against the floor to push herself around, leaving her head limp. Still flat on the ground, she rotated clockwise by inches like a fat white goldfish in a koi pond. Every minute or two, she would stop and lie still for a moment. Then she would start again. When she was facing away from Esther, she stopped and lay completely still. Esther got up and walked around to Charlotte's other side so she could see her face, wondering if Charlotte would begin inching around to escape her again. But Charlotte appeared to be looking at something. Esther got down on her knees and put her head close to where Charlotte's head was and looked. And she saw them. The lids, curled up on the floor like they were hiding under the bed. No, like trash. They smelled like trash. The whole room did. It reeked with a faint, sickly sweetness that Esther had never noticed before. She'd been sleeping on a bed of garbage. Her stomach turned. She looked around at the tiny, windowless room. Not a basement. You can't have basements at sea level. A prison. A torture chamber. The bed covered with its tattered blanket. Her whole world so small. When she looked back at Charlotte again, she knew that Charlotte didn't belong here. She'd never submit to this atmosphere. She would disrupt everything. Had disrupted everything already. She had twisted the room inside out, changed it somehow, like the inside-out t-shirt. Esther could almost read a message coming through the thin fabric of her reality, but the letters were backward and didn't make sense. She had to straighten everything out. She had to get rid of Charlotte. And she knew how. It would be a sin, but then, John David had told her often enough she was a sinner. Esther crept up the stairs. John David lay on the sofa, unmoving, and she was struck by how peaceful he looked. With his newly shaven face and without his towering height above her, he looked more like a boy than a man. There, as she'd remembered, was the tiny red bump on his Adam's apple where he'd cut himself shaving. He'd cut himself. There was a razor in the house. The most logical place to look was the bathroom attached to John David's bedroom, but she had never gone in there. All of the bedrooms were off-limits, so that even stepping into the dark, dog-legged hallway gave her a shiver of discomfort. She had seen only the kitchen and the bunker, though she was allowed to use the half-bathroom up here instead of the tiny metal toilet in the bunker, which required buckets of water to operate. When she peered into the bedrooms at the end of the hall, she understood for the first time that it was an ordinary house, even comfortable. The beds were covered with bedspreads and sheets. There were lamps, teal carpets, and wallpaper, one room covered in flowers, one pebbled with gold. On the nightstand in the unused bedroom stood a bronze deer and a box of tissues, with a knit cozy over it, and a dust ruffle sewed to the bottom. The upper reaches of the single white tissue were coated with dust, and a few severed threads of cobweb floated in the still air. John David's bedroom looked much the same. She had pictured him on a pallet of some kind, but he slept on a king-size bed under a painting of a landscape, somewhere dry with mountains, as different from Houston as she could imagine. The bathroom cabinet still held grandparent clutter. Nearly empty bottles with varying degrees of stickiness settled around their bottom edges. Small, beaked vials of eardrops and eye drops. Silver cards bubbled with fading pills. Plastic pill cases marked with the days of the week. Nothing useful. As she turned to go, she spotted one more thing. A trash can behind the door. She could just see, under a wad of tissues and curled up dental floss, a wicked glint. She looked down at Charlotte,
whose eyes wobbled with tears, her penciled eyebrows tilting upward at the middle, chin dimpled beneath the duct tape. Esther put a finger to her lips. "Shh," she warned. Then she ripped off the duct tape. They stared at each other. Charlotte's eyes were so big that for a moment the rest of her face disappeared, and Esther felt like she was looking into a mirror, staring into her own eyes, and the rest of her became disconnected. Esther took a bundle of used Kleenex out of her pocket and began unwrapping it cautiously until she felt the razor blade in her hands. A small, wicked thing. A sin. She showed Charlotte the blade and said, "Hold still." The duct tape around Charlotte's wrist was accordioned into thick, sweat-stiffened pleats. Sawing at the tape, she felt all the girl's resistance. To John David, to the hole they were in, even to her. The tension was hot in Charlotte's wrists. Charlotte had fought John David. She would fight anyone, and she'd never stop fighting. Julie, that worthless whore, had lain down without a struggle. The names popping into Esther's head were tumbling over one another, confusing her. Every tug of the blade through the duct tape freed her a little more. Freed whom, though? Charlotte? Esther? Or the other girl? She kept cutting, hearing the soft, protesting squeak of the tape against the absurdly small blade as she worked it patiently back and forth, the heavy tape grabbing and twisting at the tiny blade so that she had to stop and unstick it from time to time with a small smacking noise. After an eternity, the last fibers on one side of the thick sleeve of duct tape gave. Charlotte wrenched away from her, twisting her arms apart so that the skin stretched white and red until one of them pried itself free. Her arms were surprisingly strong for being so short and thin, but Esther knew they must be sore from being taped behind her back. Charlotte was the bravest, strongest girl she had ever seen. Tears came to Esther's eyes, and she started wriggling out of her nightshirt, keeping it right side out as she shrugged it off over her head. "Here," she said. Charlotte took the warm shirt right away and slipped into it without so much as glancing at Esther. Then she held out her hand for the razor and started hacking at the tape on her shins. Esther grabbed the sheet off the foot of the bed and wrapped it around her torso and shoulders, tucked it under her arms. She'd worn a sheet many times before.
"Give me a hand, would you? Get this thing off,"
Charlotte said, and Esther started peeling the damp swaths of slashed tape away from her calves while Charlotte kept working on the tape with the razor.
"Okay," she said. "I'm getting the fuck out of here. You're going to help me, or I'll cut you with this."
She held up the razor blade.
"Got it?"
Esther nodded with a smile. She knew Charlotte wouldn't really hurt her.
"What's your name?"
Charlotte asked.
"Esther." "Is that your real name?"
Esther thought about that, but Charlotte was already back to working on her knees.
"That guy is a sick fuck,"
Charlotte said.
"Come on, tell me your real name."
"My name is Esther."
"Like hell it is,"
Charlotte said, and with a snap she jerked the blade through the last strand of duct tape. As she clawed the tape away from her legs and stood up, the blade dropped to the floor. The barest nudge from Charlotte's foot sent it skittering away as lightly as a leaf. It stopped and spun in place on an uneven bit of concrete for a moment before coming to rest.
"Come on. Look, you helped me. You have guts. We're going to get out of here. Now what's your name?"
Julie started to speak, but Charlotte wasn't looking at her anymore. She was looking at something right behind her and opening her mouth. 15. The visitation room at the Harris County Jail is a hellish, echoing cacophony. There are no handsets to use to communicate through the plexiglass windows, and the speakers embedded in them barely work, so dozens of visitors, many with children in tow, are reduced to screaming through the glass. After Tom's first visit, I tell him not to come back, and please, for the love of God, not to let Julie come either. Instead, I call Jane. Once a day in the morning, I dial her cell phone using an insanely expensive third-party account and listen to her talk until my 15 minutes is up and the call auto-terminates. She sounds remarkably normal, tells me about her summer makeup classes, complains about finishing her papers, contemplates joining a kickball league. It's like my transgression has opened a floodgate in her,
And Jane is bubbling over with the details she'd wanted me to work so hard for before. They are details of a life that turns out to be gloriously mundane, only superficially rebellious, on the level of hair dye. Having to define herself in relation to someone who wasn't there and who was therefore always perfect was existentially confusing for Jane. Now, with an actual person to compare herself to, she doesn't seem to need the big gestures anymore. From what I can tell, she is flourishing. It's a little exhausting to listen to, but she repays my years of neglect by not asking me any questions about myself. Not even a how are you, which I appreciate. She doesn't ask about Julie either, but Tom says she and Julie email regularly. Of course I knew it was her, Jane said when I finally got up the courage to ask, speaking in a tone that suggested I was not a bad mother, just stupid. When I reminded her she was the one who told me Julie was lying about the cell phone, she said, I don't see what difference that makes. I lie all the time, but it's still me. A tiny, lonely part of me is angry that Jane hasn't offered to come home, but long days of contemplation have convinced me that she's waiting for me to ask. And until I stop being afraid she'll say no, we're at an impasse. In the meantime, I can't say I don't enjoy living vicariously through Jane a little bit. How exciting to believe in your own ability to defy the world's expectations of you even as you fulfill them, one cliche after another. I have spent my own life looking to my left and right and finding only the well-worn tracks of my own thoughts and behavior hemming me in. Maybe it's a side effect of studying the Romantics, those fetishists of originality who unwittingly invented 2 centuries' worth of platitudes. Maybe that's why I can't seem to respond normally to those who love me and whom I love. But I try with Jane. I listen. I imagine the thwack of a wet kickball against a shoe on the quad. And at the end of every phone call, I feel the dingy, fluorescent-lit jail cell settle a little heavier on my shoulders. There were witnesses. A teenage couple trudging up the lawn to make out by the glowing waterfall that night. The young man has a criminal record that will keep him off the stand, but the young woman will testify that, although she couldn't see Julie and me from where she was, the victim was clearly visible in the fountain lights, holding up his hands and pleading for his life. She heard a shot and saw him sink into the water, but she didn't make the 911 call. I did that. As luck would have it, the judge assigned to our high-profile case is a former district attorney, notorious for following her cases up the chain of appeals, attaching herself to the prosecution, and even submitting testimony condemning defendants she's already ruled against. She's also vocal about her relationship with Christ, and if I had to guess, I'd say Chuck Maxwell donated to her campaign. The thought of a godless academic rotting away in the county jail, a facility well known for abuses, perhaps getting softened up for a plea bargain at the hands of her cellmates, must appeal to Judge Crawford as much as it does to the prosecution, who file motion after motion to delay my bond hearing, using every excuse from the live stream footage of Julie whispering in Maxwell's ear to the inflamed public sentiment over this appalling attack on a pillar of the community. It's true that jail is dirty, overcrowded, humiliating, and excruciatingly boring. You can't get phone calls, incoming letters are limited in length and heavily censored, and the official process for getting a single book approved and ordered from the publisher can take months. I'd pay a lot of money for something to read to take my mind off my dismal surroundings. But if Crawford expects the inmates to harass me, she's wrong. The women leave me alone. Word must have spread pretty quickly among them that I shot the man who kidnapped and raped my daughter. That's the rumor they've heard, anyway. Proving that's what happened is much harder, of course, and my self-defense claim rests on it. At the police station, I begged them to check his DNA against the bunker house crime scene in River Oaks, and I used my one phone call to leave a message for Alex Mercado. I have to admit that although I can see the resemblance in the shape of Maxwell's low brows and hooded blue eyes, the bearded, square-jawed billboard minister doesn't otherwise bear much resemblance to 10-year-old Jane's police artist sketch of a skinny, ponytailed guy in a hoodie. And then there's what Maxwell is saying, that Julie and I were blackmailing him together. Yes, Maxwell is very much alive, not for lack of my trying. My shot hit him low on the shoulder, and he went down on his back into the shallow water before I saw the bullet wouldn't kill him. That's for the best, because if I had seen right away, I would no doubt have kept on shooting until there were no bullets left. I'm glad I didn't, and it's not because I feel Maxwell's death would have been such a great loss to the world. It's not even that I prefer to see him humiliated and exposed and put away for life rather than dead. It's just that if he died as a result of my shooting him, prosecutors might be pushing for a capital murder charge right now. In Texas, even an accidental death that occurs during the commission of a felony can be punished with the death penalty, and blackmail is a felony. When I pulled the trigger, the preservation of my own life was not high on my priority list. But everything's different now, because I have my daughter back. I wish I could say it happened in a flash, that standing there at the water wall with a gun pointed at Chuck Maxwell, I could suddenly see 13-year-old Julie and 21-year-old Julie's face, like a magic eye poster you've been staring at for weeks that suddenly leaps into focus. But that wouldn't be right, because I always saw her there. From the very beginning, from the moment she appeared on our doorstep, I knew. I just didn't believe. Her lies and evasions made doubting easier, gave me something concrete to focus on. My new version of Julie was like the optical illusion of the candlestick-shaped negative space between two profiles. Imagine two faces, Julie then and Julie now, staring at each other in profile across a gash of grief. All this time I've been seeing only the ugly shape of what's between them, the negative space of trauma. I haven't talked to Julie since I was arrested, so I still don't know what's in that black hole. But I'm ready to accept what's on either side of it. Julie before, Julie after. In the pretrial hearing, the prosecutors ask to have the trial date pushed back. At first I think it's more intimidation, keep me stewing longer, but then I hear the words River Oaks murder victim, and I know Alex Mercado must have gotten my phone message. The lead attorney on my case asks again for bail while the police investigate a link between Maxwell, Julie, and Charlotte Willard, a 13-year-old girl who disappeared from her home just across the Louisiana border in Beauregard Parish, about 6 months after Julie did. It's Charlotte Willard whose DNA they eventually matched to the remains in the bomb shelter. And it was Maxwell's grandmother who originally owned the house. I imagine Alex has left me messages to that effect on my phone, but I'll have to wait to check them. I remember what Julie called the house. Our old place. Alex was wrong about Julie being dead, but he wasn't wrong about everything. He just had the girls mixed up. Who'd escaped and who was dead. It could have gone either way, really. I think of the awful photograph again, and the horror that befell this girl who was not my daughter suffocates me. I cry for her mother and wish once more my shot had killed him. The judge denies bail again, but my attorney looks hopeful. In the hallway, she tells me of an anonymous blog post whose writer claims to have been sexually molested by Maxwell at the gate. Her mother allegedly ejected from church membership for bringing a complaint. A former member of Springshire Methodist, this one named, alleges that Maxwell was fired from a briefly held leadership position in the youth group 9 years ago after abusing her daughter. Both women were immediately served with cease and desist orders from the Gates attorneys. But by this time, other people's daughters have started coming forward. As an inmate at Harris County Jail, I can't receive phone calls, uncensored letters, or unapproved books. But I have unlimited access to legal documents related to my upcoming trial. At our next meeting, my attorney hands me a fat folder. A transcript from the deposition, she says. I think you should read this, Anna. Any distraction is welcome, and I tell her so. She sighs. What's in there? I want to warn you, it's not an easy read. Thumbing through what look to be hundreds of pages in Q&A format, I see one name after another highlighted in yellow. I feel a surge of horror. Are these all Maxwell's victims?
No, she says. Just one.
Julie still feels like someone else. She's me. I'm her. I don't mean to say I don't know that. Maybe I'm just embarrassed. Julie seems like such an idiot to me now. She used to have an imaginary friend when she was very young. It was a horse from a book. I don't even remember which one. A white horse with a silver mane. When she rode the bus in elementary school, she used to look out the window and imagine the horse galloping alongside the bus. She'd make little motions under her backpack like she was feeding him sugar. It was more than a fantasy. She could almost see him. I could almost see him. It was me. I have to tell Julie's story as if it were my own. For her sake, I'm going to try. I must have been about 5 when I asked my mom who God was. It's one of Julie's earliest memories, my earliest memories. She laughed and said, "Just some guy." When I asked her where he lived, she said, "Probably San Diego." Then she told me to go ask Dad. I did, but I don't remember what he said. I liked the idea of God living in San Diego. That's where Grandma and Grandpa retired to, which I guess was the joke. How much better it was than Houston. At the time, I knew there was a joke somewhere in her answer, but I didn't understand where. I knew she was laughing, but I thought she was laughing at me. Anyway, that summer, or maybe this happened before, I'm not really sure, we actually went to San Diego to visit Grandma and Grandpa. They had these special buckets shaped like sandcastles, so if you packed them with wet sand and turned them over, they looked like towers, with tooth-shaped ridges around the top and dents on the sides for windows. I remember I got sand stuck in my eye trying to look in through the pretend windows, and it hurt really bad. Dad helped me rinse the grit out, and after I was done crying, he said, "It's more fun anyway to just imagine what's inside." So I did. By the time Jane put her fist in one of the towers and the whole castle crumbled to the beach, I didn't mind. I had already built a new one in my mind, and it was better because nobody could destroy it. I'm not saying that these things had anything to do with what happened later on. I'm just bringing them up to say Julie had a history of belief. She wanted to believe there was an inside to the castle, even though she'd packed it full of wet sand herself. She wanted to believe God was a beautiful man who lived with her beautiful grandparents on a beautiful beach, and maybe someday they could all live together inside that beautiful imaginary castle. On the same trip, Dad told me glass was made out of melted sand. How was God any harder to believe than that? I keep trying to find the before. But once something like that happens to you, there is no before anymore. It takes the before away. And if there's no before, then there's no order I can tell it in that makes any sense, and no reason to choose one particular place over any other. I'd start with the shame, but everything gets there eventually, so no hurry, I guess. I met Charlie in Sunday school the summer after the 7th grade when I went to church with Candace. I don't know if my parents would even remember Candace. She always wore these big bows in her hair that her mom made with a hot glue gun to match her outfits. Julie was a little jealous of them. I was jealous, I mean. I can't imagine caring about that, but Julie did. Candace's mom bought her pretty clothes and made pretty bows to go with them. My mom just sort of looked at me when I wore pretty clothes, her lips pressed together. She's very serious. She's a professor. Anyway, I went to Sunday school for the first time with Candace, and there he was. Not Chuck Maxwell from the article I found all those years later, not even John David yet, just Charlie, a skinny guy with a guitar leading the class in a half hour of songs. I liked school fine, but this was different. There was one kid at school who was, I don't know what you're supposed to call it, but in 7th grade they said retarded and threw french fries at him in the cafeteria. His name was Jason. In
In Sunday school, Jason sat with the cool kids in the front row, and nobody bothered him, not even the boys. He looked so happy, singing along and doing the arm motions that went with the songs. It was almost like he had friends. Charlie made everyone feel that way. The rest of church was confusing to me. The hallways were hung with felt banners showing scenes from the Bible. Women putting babies in baskets and floating them down the river. Women carrying water jugs on their heads. Women washing Jesus' feet with their hair. But the sermons were always about traffic or primetime television or an article in Newsweek, which didn't seem to have anything to do with the banners and the hymns and the Bible readings. Candace and I would tune out and write each other notes on the church bulletins using the golf pencils in the backs of the pews, make little cartoons with speech bubbles. Her parents didn't care as long as we stayed quiet. After the service, Candace and I would link arms and walk down to the Sunday school room, which had sofas and a big screen TV and posters on the wall that looked like graffiti but with Bible verses. There was no sermon in Sunday school, just goofy songs. And then what Charlie called real talk, where we sat on the floor in a circle. Sometimes it would start with a Bible verse, but pretty soon kids would begin talking about their problems. A lot of problems were about girls, what they wore, who they danced with, whether they were godly, and how godly were they, and how much did it matter. One week they spent the whole time debating if it was okay for a girl to lie and say she liked her friend's outfit if she actually hated it. I remember one guy in the eighth grade wanted to ask a Jewish girl out, and they talked for an hour about whether or not Jews were going to hell, and if they were, whether it was their responsibility to share Jesus' message with them. Some kids were concerned about the silver James Avery crosses that were popular, whether girls should be wearing them if they were wearing them only for looks. I watched from the sidelines. In our house, my mom was all-knowing, and my dad could answer any question in a way I understood. But it turned out there were questions I didn't even know needed asking. A whole world happening in another dimension, and my parents didn't seem to know anything about it. It turned out there were battles being fought all around me, that every word and action had a deeper meaning, and even the jewelry that a person wore could be related to something called salvation. Charlie didn't egg them on. He just sat on the floor and listened, nodding when the arguments got more heated. Then, toward the end of the hour, he'd finally start talking, and everybody would shut up. He'd explain that God was watching us, and that he loved us more than we could possibly love ourselves, and that all we had to do was try to be worthy of that love. Jesus, he said, had become a man so he could understand what it was like. He understood how hard it was not to sin, and he paid the ultimate price so we wouldn't have to. Class dismissed. In other words, Charlie didn't give us any answers at all. Candace was happy to supply the answers that Charlie wouldn't. "No offense," she said one day while we were walking down the hall after service, "but the Bible says your parents are going to hell." That was the day I cried in Sunday school. I was so embarrassed I couldn't even speak when Charlie asked if I wanted to stay afterward and talk. But I nodded. "Yes." There's no before anymore. Everything in my memory is colored by what happened, like one of those old photographs where the tints are all weird. His offer to drive me home after Candace rolled her eyes and said her parents were waiting in the breezeway, so could I please hurry up? His smile when he said Candace and I shouldn't tell our parents or anyone else he was driving me home, because there was a lot of insurance paperwork he'd have to fill out first. His assurance when Candace left the room that he was willing to risk it, because I was special. I mean, he didn't come out and say that, but he implied it. I was special. Me, Julie, unchurched child of unchurched parents. Not even Easter and Christmas parents, but never ever parents. When Charlie and I sat together in his office with the door cracked open, and I asked how God could damn my parents and Jane to hell, he told me that only God could judge, and anyone who said anyone else was going to hell was trying to do God's job, and that wasn't right. But not believing in God isn't right either, I said. The Bible says you have to believe in Jesus.
The Bible also says it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven, he said with a smirk. I wasn't sure whether we were rich or not, but I knew for certain Candace was. I'd slept over at her house enough times.
Then he said the important thing wasn't whether anyone else was damned, but whether you yourself were saved. He said I was very brave to come to church on my own. He said I had the soul of a seeker. My whole life, ever since I could remember, I'd always hated the thought that no one could ever know what anyone else was feeling or thinking. The fact that no one could ever be inside my head with me seemed like the loneliest thing in the world. I wanted so bad for there to be something that could make those boundaries just disappear. Something so big it was like air, a magic flowing across the planet, connecting everyone and everything. When Charlie spoke to me, I saw the boundaries disappearing. Now I see a careful distance narrowing. Charlie drove me home from church 3 times. Each time he dropped me off in the parking lot at the CVS at Kirkwood, and I'd buy something cheap, candy or a magazine, so that when I walked the 4 blocks home, I'd have an explanation for why Candace's parents had dropped me off there. I had the answer all worked out, but my mom never asked. It was spring, and she was usually doing something in the yard when I got home with my plastic CVS bag. I guess she never thought about how uncomfortable it was to walk 4 blocks in church flats. In the parking lot of the CVS, my conversations with Charlie went deeper than the ones we had in his little cubby in the church office, where the church secretary kept barging in to use the copier. In the CVS parking lot, Charlie told me that he wasn't sure he even believed in hell. He told me everybody wants a rule book, that people want an instruction manual to life. They want to be told exactly what to do, but Jesus came to destroy all that. Jesus came to erase the laws that were written on the stone tablets and write them on our hearts instead. He told me Jesus wants us to feel what's right inside when we pray to him. God sent Jesus as a man, he says, to teach us how to be men. His hand rested on the back of my seat, and I could smell that he used some kind of prickly aftershave and see that he had blue eyes and that his blonde eyelashes were longer than I'd thought. Never forget this, he told me, and I haven't. People will always let you down. Candace will let you down. Your parents will let you down. I will let you down. Only God will always be there for you. I nodded, staring into his eyes. His thumb was touching my shoulder just a little. He took his hand off the seat back, letting out his breath. I'd been holding mine, too. Back in my bedroom, I changed out of church clothes, but instead of going downstairs, I crept into bed and pulled the covers over my head. God sent Jesus as a man to teach us how to be men. Who had God sent to teach me how to be a woman? Was it Charlie? When I went back to Sunday school the next week, he was gone. One of the church elders, a woman in her 50s, ran the Sunday school class. She told us that for personal reasons, Charlie had had to resign. It was unlikely he'd be able to return to the position, she said. They were already beginning the search for a new youth pastor, and in the meantime, fellowship would be suspended and Sunday school would be taught by members of the Christian Education Committee.
Can we say goodbye?
Someone asked.
I'll get a card, Candace said. We can all sign it.
That would be very nice, the elder said. Now get out your Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13.
Even I knew that verse. It was printed on the church bulletins and embroidered on some of the tapestries in the halls. At this time, the words seemed to be pointed straight at me. If I have a faith that can move mountains but have not love, I am nothing. Charlie had said he would let me down, and he was right. With Charlie gone, church got very boring, and I stopped sleeping over at Candace's house. At school, I went out for the track team and made it.
I was not a good speed runner, but I could run distances, and I could propel myself into the air and sail over the hurdles with my legs in front of me. Looking around at the girls I'd be training with over the summer, all of us standing on the dusty track, our skinny legs sticking out of nylon shorts, I knew I didn't need Candace or Church or Charlie anymore. In eighth grade, I would have friends, real girlfriends, who would show me how to brush my hair, put on makeup, and talk to boys. The girls on the track team had sleepovers and away meets. They painted racing stripes and Nike swooshes on one another's faces, finished each other's sentences. They were a tribe. When I was in eighth grade, my life would finally begin. A few months later, I got the chat invitation. His name was John David. There was no picture, just an outline of a head with a question mark inside it. According to his Facebook page, he was 16, and he had zero friends on his profile. I tried to think of all the people I knew who went to high school. My friend Angela had an older brother named John, and had a crush on him once. Or maybe John David was somebody I knew from school who was just lying about his age, or some mean girls playing a trick on me. Maybe I was going to get reeled in with some phony secret admirer plot, and they would take screenshots and post them for the whole school to see. Something like that happened to a girl I barely knew, Rebecca. There were other things that had happened to Rebecca, too. I unfriended her on Facebook so I didn't have to see them. I refreshed the screen, half expecting to see the profile's friends shoot up to the hundreds so that I'd know he was a fake, a bot, an empty outline. Nothing happened, except the question mark took a little longer to load the second time. He couldn't contact me until I had accepted his offer, so I clicked on the question mark and a chat box popped up. "Hi, who are you?" I typed. I always typed out words and added punctuation and capitals, even in chats with friends. I was reading the diary of Anne Frank and couldn't stand how ugly most of my and my friends' writing looked in comparison with those sentences from a girl our age. The chat box was blank for a few minutes. Then it started blinking as the person on the other end typed. The other person was not into spelling things correctly or capitalizing. "I don't want to give my real name." "Do I know you?" I wrote back. There was a long delay while he typed, long enough to make me think he was typing from a phone. We had amazing conversations together. I started to type another question, and then the chat box blinked again. "Soul of a seeker." A wave of heat went up my body, starting from my toes and rushing up to my face until it was burning. I typed, "Charlie?" but stopped myself from pressing the enter key just in time and deleted it. "Julie, you there?" I let out my breath slowly and typed, "I think I know who you are. You gave me a ride home a few times." That sounded like I could be talking to a 16-year-old. I wondered how old he really was. "Yes." "Where are you now? You left without saying goodbye."
"I had my reasons. You don't know my side of things."
"Side?" I frowned and typed again. "Where are you now?"
"I can't see you right now or tell you where I am. I have reasons. You are always smarter than the others. Wanted to get back in touch."
"It's nice to hear from you," I said, because I didn't know what else to say. There was another pause.
"God is with you all the time. I can see him all around you like a halo."
My scalp prickled and I could feel his eyes on me suddenly, almost like I'd felt them on our last car ride home together. I wondered how far away he was. "Why did you leave? You left without saying goodbye."
"I promise I'll tell you the whole story soon, but please for now just talk to me. I'm lonely."
I tried to picture him in front of a computer screen or hunched over a phone somewhere, but I couldn't. I typed out the words, "I miss you," but then I backed the cursor up over them until they were gone and typed, "Everyone misses you," instead. He responded,
"I miss you too,"
just as if he could hear the real sentence in my head.
"Something really important has happened to me since we talked. I'm going to tell you everything. God has a plan for me and for you, too."
This time he didn't have to tell me not to tell my parents. He knew I wouldn't, and I knew he knew. And although the word God sent the old thrill spiking through me, it was Charlie's faith in me and the greatness of his